Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of the program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls. In this hour of Focus, we will look back to some of the history of the American Southwest, really going back to the time before it was the American Southwest. And our guest for the program is Hampton Sides, and we'll be talking about his newly published book, which is titled Blood and Thunder, An Epic of the American West. And it talks about a lot of things, about American expansionism, about the results of the war with Mexico, about continuing battles between indigenous people and Americans in this territory. And at the center of this story is one individual. The man is Kit Carson. According to our guest, Carson was a hunter, an explorer, a rancher, a soldier. In fact, Hampton Sides says that Kit Carson did just about everything there was to do in the American West. And he says, more than any other individual, Kit Carson personified westward expansion. Some people would consider him to be a hero. Many Native Americans think that he is a mass murderer. This morning, we'll be talking a bit about Kit Carson, about the Navajo, and about the battle for control of the Southwest, which is the subject of the book, Blood and Thunder. It is published by Doubleday. It is out now in the bookstore, if you'd like to look at it. Our guest, Hampton Sides, is editor-at-large for Outside Magazine. He is the author of the international bestseller Ghost Soldiers, which was the basis for a film in 2005, The Great Raid. It also won the 2002 Penn USA Award for Nonfiction. His magazine work has twice been nominated for National Magazine Awards for Feature Writing. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions, comments are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can get in as many different callers as possible, but certainly anyone's welcome to call. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Sides, hello.
Hey, thanks for having me on your show.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. And I think that I'm sure a lot of people, when they think about the West, capital letters, the West, they think about that a particular time and a particular version of that time that comes to us from popular culture. What they're thinking of is the West of the 1880s. What you're doing here is you're taking us back 40 years. You're going back to the 1840s, to a time that is really before that. This is before the Civil War. It's before the gunfight at the OK Corral. It's before Little Bighorn. It's before all of that, and really before the territory that we're talking about, California, Arizona, New Mexico, before that was part of the United States. What interests you in going back to that particular time? And then perhaps a further bigger question is, in what sense is it important to understand that to then get on to understand the America that came after?
Yeah, those are good questions. I kind of view the period that I'm writing about as a pre-Western. It's a time when the cliches that you've talked about, which really sprang up during the 1870s and 1880s, that we think of as Western, before those cliches had begun to solidify. And it's a more interesting time, it seems to me. I mean, well, first of all, I should say I never particularly liked Westerns. You know, as a genre, I never particularly gravitated towards Western movies or Western books. They seemed formulaic to me, and I don't know. I've never really been a horse guy, or, you know, I live out here in Santa Fe, which is the kind of the world capital of wannabe cowboys and wannabe Indians and spiritual cowboys and all that. So I never really, although I live here, I was never drawn to Westerns per se. But when I got onto this subject, the pre-West, it just seemed so much more interesting, because, I mean, it's a very, first, just sort of cosmetically, it's a very different West. And, you know, instead of riding horses, most of these guys are riding mules. Instead of driving cattle, they're driving sheep. Most of the white guys are speaking Spanish or French, having been trappers. And, there are no Stetson hats, there are no cowboy hats, black or white. So it's a very different world, and an interesting time to begin to see where all those cliches came from. And so that's really one of the main themes of the book is to try to kind of take it back to the origins, to the time when the American government was just beginning to make its stamp on this vast territory.
Mm-hmm. Well, this, as you say, this was a time when in this territory there would have been Americans wandering around. There were people like Kit Carson. There were Americans in U.S. citizens living in California. So there were people going back and forth kind of through this territory, but formally this was not part of the United States. This was part of Mexico. At what point, and who was it perhaps in back in Washington that determined that, I know that there was certainly more than one person. There was a number of important voices saying, you know, this is ours and is and should be, and let's go get it.
But right.
Who, in particular, though, who was it was leading the charge, in a sense, to saying, we need to take this territory and mm-hmm. it should become part of the United States?
Well, you know, the rallying cry of westward expansion in the 1840s was manifest destiny. You know, this whole idea that that we should be a continental nation, we should have ports on the Pacific, and it was our right to have this land. The president who really brought manifest destiny into some sort of reality was the 11th president of the United States, James K. Polk from Tennessee. Strange little man, very dour, very uncharismatic, hardworking. But he had this vision that all that land out there, and all of it, I mean, you know, the western third of the United States should be ours, and it should be ours almost overnight. I mean, he only served one term. He vowed that he would only serve one term, and so his presidency had this sense of deadline, accelerated timeline. He tried to sort of have it all. He wanted to buy this land if possible. When Mexico wouldn't sell it, we went, you know, we basically provoked a war and took this land. And while simultaneously negotiating with the British over Oregon Territory, and, you know, by the time he left office, he, you know, the national domain had expanded by a third, and he had aged dramatically in those 4 years. If you look at the before and after photographs, they're astonishing. He was quite ill, haggard looking. He went home to Tennessee, and within 3 months he was dead. But suddenly we have this great vast territory out here, not really sure, at least we have it on paper, but we're not really sure how to govern it. And you asked me, the first question was, you know, what drew me to this story. I couldn't help but notice many of the similarities between, say, the Iraq War and the Mexican War as it pertained to the American Southwest, because we came in here and we really thought we'd be welcomed as deliverers. We thought it would be very easy. It was initially very easy in terms of it was a bloodless conquest, but then the occupation became a very different story, very messy, very bloody, very difficult, and we realized that we had absorbed this giant land out here that we knew nothing about. We knew nothing about the cultures, and we had pledged ourselves to making it secure. Which proved to be a very, you know, very bloody, very complicated task, and very expensive task that took, you know, decades and decades to accomplish.
Yeah, I suppose here the people in Washington would have thought here, particularly the great prize was California.
Yes.
And that it also made sense for us to have everything in between for a number of reasons, and that didn't quite take into consideration the fact that there were people living there. There were people who identified themselves with Mexico. Mm-hmm. There were indigenous people like the Navajo that we'll talk about. So there were all kinds of people there who were already there and had been there for a very long time.
Right. Yeah, and the American Indians, like the Navajos, didn't even enter the radar screen in Washington. You know, there was the issue of what to do with those Hispanic Catholic folks who had claimed entitled to all this land for so long. But, you know, the idea that there were also American Indians who had been here even longer really was kind of an afterthought. Oh, yeah, what are we going to do about that problem? So that's where, you know, the second half of the book begins to focus on that issue.
Yeah, and I think also here, I think it's... It's interesting because, again, if people think about conflict between the Americans and between the indigenous people, they probably, again, in the popular imagination, they focus on battles between Indians and Americans in the Great Plains, and that this and don't really think about this particular chapter of battles between expansionist Americans and indigenous people in the Southwest. They don't really think about great battles taking place between the Army and between the Navajo. You just don't. That's just not probably the thing that people think of, because we haven't been given those images.
Yeah, I think so much of our understanding of the Indian Wars is focused on the Sioux and several other Plains Indian tribes, and you know, George Armstrong Custer, and that's sort of that generation. And this is just an earlier take, an earlier version, almost a prologue to those later battles.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580 Hampton Sides, his new book is Blood and Thunder, an Epic of the American West. It's published by Doubleday. It takes its title from the kind of pulp novels of the time that recounted the adventures of guys, well, like Kit Carson. They were known as Blood and Thunders. So that's one level on which the title works. And certainly, as I said at the beginning, Kit Carson and his life story. It's not exactly a biography of Kit Carson, but it is his life story, and talks about how his life story was interwoven with the other things that happened during this period in the Southwest. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455.
You know, those Blood and Thunders that you mentioned, what was interesting about them was that, you know, they were enormously popular and made Kit Carson a celebrity within his own time, and kind of made him out to be a kind of action figure hero, always bigger and more dashing and more eloquent than he actually was. But the interesting thing was that he hated these books. He never got a cent from them. He never gave his consent to use his name. And the ultimate irony was that he couldn't read them because he was illiterate. So these atrocious books, and I would dare you to read them, they are terrible books. They're, you know, they're kind of pulp. You know, they're almost like comic books. But Carson had to have someone else read them to him, and they in turn gave him this celebrity that he spent the rest of his life trying to kind of live down. He was almost embarrassed by his fame, and although his actual exploits are almost as incredible as the exploits in those pulp Blood and Thunders, those books nonetheless raised this expectation that he could meet any foe and you know, defeat anybody and accomplish any mission. So it kind of raised the bar, and he spent most of his, you know, the latter part of his life trying to best himself, and the public expectations and the appetite for more really was part of the dynamic of his life story.
Mm-hmm. Well, the man had a remarkable life, starting from the point when he was a teenager, and did as you describe it some material that came with the book, and I think it's a pretty fair way of saying it, that he did everything that there was to do. He was a hunter, and he was a trapper, and he was a scout, and he was an explorer, and he was a soldier, and he was a rancher. Just about every possible way of making a living, every possible thing that you could do, he did.
Yeah, he had this curious way of kind of being one step ahead of developments in the West, and moving effortlessly from and morphing almost from one profession to another, and great sense of serendipity about his life. It seemed like everything he did, he just met the right person at the right time and moved into this new sort of existence. And he also moved fairly effortlessly in and out of the different worlds of the American West. I mean, you know, he spoke French, he spoke Spanish. He spoke a number of different American Indian tongues. His first two wives were American Indians. His first was Arapaho. She died during childbirth, and then he married a Cheyenne woman, who actually that marriage didn't last very long because she kicked him out of her teepee, what they call the Cheyenne divorce. Then he married a Hispanic woman from Taos. So, you know, he was, I guess you could say, multicultural before that was even a word, before that was hip, and seemed to very easily seg, you know, in and out of these different worlds and keep one step ahead of history.
Yeah. Just we're in a sense getting a little bit ahead of the story, but to pick up on the point of his seeming understanding for sympathy with contact with Indian people, that how it is you line that up with his reputation among many Indian people as a murderer. I think, again, in some of the material that came with the book, you said that a friend of yours who was a Navajo says, "We think of Kit Carson the way Jews think of Hitler." So he is a man with a complex kind of reputation for being a hero adventurer on the one side and being a genocidal murderer on the other side.
Yeah, a very complex legacy that he has. Yeah, well, you know, I understand why the Navajos hate the guy who conquered them, and I can understand why American Indians focus on the handful of incidents in his life that are very, very difficult to explain. And I would, you know, I would not use the word genocidal, even though it has been used. I mean, genocidal to me implies, you know, a desire to exterminate an entire people, an entire race of people. And everything you read about Kit Carson and his Indian policy and his days as an Indian agent, it's very clear that he had great sympathy for American Indians and generally sided with them over the whites and white settlers. He kept saying things like, you know, the quote-unquote Indian problems are as often as not caused by the aggressions of the whites. And he was genuinely alarmed in the latter part of his life that American Indians were going to become extinct. And here's a guy who had many friends among American Indians, had married among them, had traveled the West with them. And what's interesting about Kit Carson is that in a way he didn't think about American Indians, you know, in some sort of abstract way, in a monolithic way. He thought about tribes. You know, there's the Arapaho, there's the Blackfeet, there's the Cheyenne, there's the Utes, on and on it goes. Each tribe was different from one another. They had alliances with one another. They fought with one another. They had different traditions and cultures and languages and were whole worlds unto themselves. And he very much appreciated that, you know, that reality. So, you know, to try to understand some of his actions, often it comes down to kind of a tribal loyalty that he had. There were certain tribes that he had an affinity for and a relationship with, like the Utes. And other tribes that were the enemies of those tribes, like the Navajo. In a weird way, he actually thought more like an American Indian than a white guy, and this whole issue of tribal loyalty comes up over and over in the book as one of the motivating factors in his psyche.
Well, and just to make one basic point, I think that one, maybe you need to try and put yourself in the frame of mind of him and others at the time who would have said that they were genuinely worried about the survival of Indian people, and who felt that, and now we can say that this was wrong, this was completely wrong-headed, that everything that we did was wrong. We can say that now, but I think you have to acknowledge the fact that their thought that of taking Indian people and putting them on reservations and trying to get them to abandon their traditional ways of living for a more conventional way of life, being farmers, being ranchers, living like European Americans, that they thought that was the what had to happen for Indian people to survive at all.
Yeah.
And that
and the term they used was that was their alternative to extinction.
Yeah.
Essentially, we have to settle down, stop being nomadic, become a Christian farmer, and live in fairly dense communities like the Pueblo Indians here in the Southwest, and completely rewire your mode of existence And as hard as that sounds to do, it was believed that that was the only alternative to their fairly quick extinction. So that's the kind of environment. And it is important when you're going to look at someone like Kit Carson, someone who has this obviously very controversial legacy. It's really important as a historian that you really try to put yourself in his time and to judge him, if you're going to judge him, by his standards of his day. You know, thank God we've evolved a lot in our understanding of race and ethnicity and religion and, you know, women's rights and so many other issues. But it really doesn't, it's really a silly exercise to judge someone who lived in the 1840s by today's standards. Because, you know, it's certainly not a historical act that you're, you know, when you do that.
Mm-hmm. I have a caller here we'll get to just in a second. I'll introduce again our guest, Hampton Sides. He is editor-at-large for Outside Magazine. His new book is Blood and Thunder, An Epic of the American West. It's published by Doubleday, and it tells the story of the expansion of the U.S. into what is now the southwestern United States. Battles with indigenous people, and most prominently the Navajo, and all the way running through this story is an account of the life of Kit Carson, who was very much involved in a lot of this history. It's a good book. You can go out and take a look at it. It's in the bookstore now. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone here on the phone in Indiana on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. It'd be nice if this book got on some high school reading list, that's for sure. A couple of things. One, I was wondering if you could embellish the thing about there were a number of tribes he had an affinity to. I was wondering what those sensitivities were that made him want to go to this particular tribe or not go to that particular tribe. Mm-hmm. And secondly, let's do bring him into the 21st century. He sounds awful lot like those fellows go around straightening out companies to me that were sort of in the vogue back in the 70s, sort of instant manager types. And I just wonder where we might place him in terms of, career echelons right now. It sounds like he's an awful interesting person. And I guess another throw-in would be you must be difficult to fight popular culture to get these things straightened out. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, well, when you're writing about Kit Carson, it's really hard to sort out the myth from the reality. That's always true in history, but him particularly, because a couple of reasons. One is so much of what is the popular conceptions about Kit Carson derive from those terrible Blood and Thunder books, which were completely fictitious. The second thing is he was illiterate, so he didn't write very much down. So we don't have the luxury of really knowing exactly what he thought and felt about a lot of these issues. And then, you know, the Indian side of the story is generally oral history passed down through the generations. And so although I do use it and quote it and refer to it often in my book, it is something that a lot of conventional historians kind of look askance at, using oral history. So the documents are not real firm in dealing with this, and so there's a little bit more than the usual amount of sorting myth from reality. As far as Kit Carson's affinity for different tribes, hard to know exactly why he was drawn to one or the other. A lot of it goes back to his days as a trapper, and those tribes that they were able to strike alliances with, they held those friendships for life. That is another thing about Kit Carson, is that tribal loyalty being a big thing, but personal loyalty. I mean, if you were his friend, you couldn't shake it. You know, you couldn't become his enemy. It was almost personal loyalty to an extreme. And if you were his enemy, you're his enemy for life. So I don't know. That's very common among many of the men that I researched in doing this book. Personal loyalty, tribal loyalty. But the Utes had long been friends with some of the trappers. Same is true with the Cheyenne and the Arapaho. So I don't know. I think it goes way back to those trapper days and the Frenchmen who were able to strike alliances with a lot of those tribes.
All right. Let's talk with someone else here, someone in Champaign County. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I have trouble on the line here, apparently, so excuse that. I wanted to know a couple of things. Did you look through the American Indian historians, like, let's say, Vin Deloria, Custer Died for Your Sins? I read it so many years ago, I don't remember much about it, except the takeaway seemed to me that he was saying this idea of the cowboys as being, you know, strenuous, enterprising, and all that was a myth, that being a pastoral sheep or cowherder was one of the least demanding things that you could do. I don't know.
I've certainly read some of his books, and I read a lot of N. Scott Momade, another great Indian writer. But, yeah, I mean, what we were saying at the beginning of the program, though, is that this really is about a period before, you know, they became cowboys. And it was a very strenuous life, just because it was so remote from everything. You know, it was difficult to be alive at all in the 1860s, 1850s, and even 1840s. But to be alive way out on the, you know, periphery of the known world was very difficult. I mean, in terms of just putting food in your belly and staying alive and surviving. And the life of the trapper was a very difficult life. I mean, it was very free. They had complete freedom in a sense, but it was extremely dangerous and wet and cold and it was a very difficult life. So as far as what happens when they become cowboys, and you know, I don't even get into that period, and I actually try to stay away from it.
I see.
This is kind of a snapshot of the American West before that period that Vine Deloria is writing about.
Well, the Civil War is through that period, and the dramatization in Yang Li's film, I forget the name of the book, the name of the film, of the chaos of Missouri in the Civil War is just was pretty astonishing. And but I actually wanted to ask about sort of saying that, you know, westward expansion was opposed in some ways by some people, Lincoln voting against the Mexican-American War and that sort of thing, because of slavery, because of perhaps of just a non-wage labor kind of system. Do you have any insights on that, or is that too...
No, I mean, it figures into the story. There were plenty of opponents to the Mexican War, and a great fear that we would not, as a nation, be able to absorb a primarily Hispanic Catholic population. There was a lot of people who just didn't believe it was feasible. I mean, some people were racist, I guess, but other people, honestly, I think, wondered whether it was possible, just as a government, to absorb a very different population. And a lot of people also said, "What in the hell are we doing here, trying to conquer a godforsaken desert? This land is not worth anything until you get to California." That was the perception at the time. And for years after the Mexican War, there were many people in Washington who argued strongly for giving all this land back to Mexico because it was just considered too expensive to keep and hold, too violent, too many wars and internecine conflicts, and too impoverished.
That so, would be in the 50s or 40s or when?
This would have been in the 1850s and 1860s. And of course, the other issue that you touched on that was hovering over all of this was slavery. The question was, okay, we expand to the West. What does that mean in terms of which states will become free states and which will become slave states? And all of that came to a head during the Civil War when a group of soldiers from Texas marched up to the Rio Grande and tried to take New Mexico and Colorado and ultimately wanted to take the entire American West and win it for the Confederacy so that they would have their own port on the Pacific and, you know, slave markets in Los Angeles and you know, cotton plantations and in the Sacramento River Valley and all that. This push of the Texan Confederates was was stopped in its tracks by the New Mexican Volunteers and the Army here, and of course, right in the middle of it again was Kit Carson fighting on the side of the Union, which was not a given. He was originally from Missouri and could easily have gone to the side of the Confederacy, but for a variety of reasons, he chose to fight for the Union.
Is there anybody that we would recognize in name that would identify with that Texan movement? Or?
Well, the general, General Sibley, was actually from Louisiana. But I'm trying to think in terms of names that later became famous during the Civil War. Probably not. On the Union side, there was a general, then a colonel who became a general, named Canby, who went straight away to Washington and figured into the war plans. But trying to think, probably not. I mean, it was two fairly obscure but quite fierce battles that were fought here in New Mexico. I don't think very many Civil War buffs even know about them. And it's just interesting that Kit Carson again kind of pops up like a, almost like a jack in the box. He just, wherever there's something happening out in the West, he seems to be in the middle of it.
Do you go into why he decided to go the side he went on? Or?
To an extent, I do. It had a lot to do with personal loyalty again. He had been a scout for the U.S. Army and the U.S. Army Topographical Corps on three expeditions, and that was where his loyalty was to the U.S. Army and to his former boss, who was an explorer named John C. Fremont, who had become an abolitionist and was the first Republican candidate for president, and during the Civil War was a general on the Union side. So again, Carson's throwing his lot in with his former boss. I think that had a lot to do with it. I think he was against slavery, in a sense, but here's another irony. He had three Navajo servants working in his house, and some have called them slaves outright. Others have said they were sort of indentured servants. He certainly freed at least one of them, we know. But, you know, the issue of slavery and his feelings about slavery were probably secondary to this whole issue of personal loyalty. That and also another thing, which is that people here in New Mexico, even to this day, have a thing about Texans. They just, it's a love-hate thing, and mostly back then a hate thing. The fact that this wasn't just a Confederate army, but a Texan army, was the rallying cry that allowed Carson to raise a large group of Hispanic volunteers to fight these guys. If it had been an army coming from Georgia or something, I don't know if the reaction would have been quite the same.
Let's talk with someone else on the cell phone here, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A very intriguing phone call show. Just a couple of quick questions, and I'll ring off and let you comment. You mentioned earlier about a couple of the instances with the Indians, and I was wondering if you could expound on that as far as you mentioned they thought he was involved in genocide. But you did say that, you know, a couple of things that he was involved in were kind of hard to explain, and I was just wondering if you could expound on maybe one or two of those.
Yeah.
I was wondering then how long he lived, what year did he die, did he die of natural causes,
mm-hmm.
and then if you had any information on his parents, where he came from. And
yeah.
I'll go ahead and ring off and listen. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, start with the last part. He was born in Kentucky in 1809 and was raised in Missouri, and ran away from home at age 16 on the Santa Fe Trail, ended up in New Mexico, and spent the rest of his life living in and out of Taos, New Mexico, which is where he's buried. He lived until 1868, and weirdly enough, he did die of natural causes. As many scrapes and battles and conflicts as he was in, he actually died on a bed of buffalo robes, a little place in southeastern Colorado. He died of an aneurysm in his aorta that ruptured. But he seemed to know the end was near. He could tell that this aorta was pressing against his his chest cavity, and he ordered up this big buffalo steak, kind of his final meal, and had his doctor read to him stories from his autobiography. about his exploits as a young man, and then the aneurysm ruptured and he died. He's buried in Taos with his wife, Josefa, and his grave has been desecrated by vandals, presumably American Indian vandals who have called him a Nazi and spray painted swastikas on his gravestone. Some of the incidents that I mentioned that are hard to explain. One of them involves something that happened during the third Fremont expedition. And they were out in Oregon doing some mapping, and they were, as guides, they had hired a number of these Delaware Indians, another tribe that figures into Kit Carson's life. And the Delaware Indians were sitting in their campfire when they were attacked by Klamath Indians, and the Delaware Indians were killed, as well as a Frenchman. So Kit Carson and Fremont kind of go on a warpath to avenge the death of their friends. And when they do this, they go on a kind of overkill. I mean, they go into these villages and kill everyone they can find, not women and children, but all men. And we have later found out that they probably picked the wrong tribe, that they were probably attacked originally by Modoc Indians, and instead went and attacked Klamath Indians. So, but anyway, this is just one of several incidents that, this was a massacre, I would say, and it's really hard to reconcile all the things that Kit Carson said and believed about American Indians with some of these episodes. So anyway, that's one. Hmm.
I want to make sure that in the time that's left, we talk about the battles between the U.S. government and the Navajo, because
sure.
That's a really important part of the story. And we talked about the fact that the United States, that the government was determined to take the Southwest from Mexico, that they really wanted California, and that they also took the territory that ends up being Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, Nevada, a big chunk of territory, and that there were people there who considered themselves Mexican, and then they were indigenous people, there were Indian people, among them the Navajo. And I think that one of the points, one of the stories that you tell here is about the Navajo resistance to the United States, that there was some of the fiercest of any of the people in that territory in resisting the United States. Mm-hmm. Why did that happen?
Well, the Navajos were the largest tribe in the American Southwest, living on the largest piece of real estate, and even today, I mean, they're now the largest American Indian tribe, period, and their reservation is the largest reservation in the U.S. So it's, for one thing, it's just a giant tribe, and a very proud and very fierce tribe. They weren't warriors in the traditional sense of they wouldn't fight very often in very large numbers, in concentrated battle scenarios. What they were was expert raiders. They were really good at coming in the middle of the night and stealing cattle and sheep and horses and women and children, and sort of terrorizing the neighborhoods along the Rio Grande. And this is a war that had been going on for several centuries. The word terrorizing was, in fact, used in a lot of these documents. You see it often. And they were kind of viewed as terrorists. I mean, they would sweep in kind of from nowhere, take all of this livestock and women and children, and then disappear into their landscape of the Navajo country. I'm sure many of your listeners have been there. It's riddled with caves and canyons, and it's beautiful, stark, fascinating, weird-looking country. But it made it really hard for the Hispanic. I should go back even to the Spanish period, and then the Mexican period, and then finally the American period. It was very hard for the military leaders to pursue the Navajos into this wrinkled country. And in that sense, you might say it's somewhat analogous to maybe the war in Afghanistan. The army spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to fight them and how to meet them in some kind of conventional battle. And they kind of lived in the shadows. They could evaporate, and it made life very difficult for the American military. And they started building forts deep into Navajo country, and then they finally got to a point where they, you know, they realized that the Navajos were going to continue to do what they did unless some very drastic measures were taken. And Kit Carson got this mission, and during the height of the Civil War, to go into Navajo country, round up the Navajos, and move them to another location out on the plains, on the Pecos River, where they were supposedly going to learn to become Christian farmers. And but Carson very quickly found, again, that he could not fight the Navajos. He had to fight their land. It became essentially a scorched earth policy a full year before Sherman executed his more famous scorched earth policy across the American South, in which he essentially chopped down every cornfield and destroyed every melon patch and bean patch. His soldiers guarded all the water sources and the salt sources. They killed every sheep and every cow and every horse they encountered. And finally, the Navajos began to starve, and in very large numbers over the course of about a year, they began to give themselves up. And so Carson, you know, the scorched earth policy, as brutal as it was, it did essentially work. And 9,000 Navajos trickled out of the mountains and canyons and went on this long forced relocation, a kind of a forced march, which they call the Long Walk. It's the second largest forced relocation after the Cherokee's Trail of Tears in our history. And they were marched 400 miles away to this really bleak place out on the plains, and this experiment, essentially, to turn them into a very different kind of people was an abysmal failure, and ended up a third of the people there died of diseases, and they starved to death, and it was a terrible failure, and that really forms the last or third of my book, is talking about this experiment to convert the Navajos and rewire their whole society.
Yeah, and if other aspects of Kit Carson's life weren't enough, certainly this chapter of his leading the fight of the Americans against the Navajo and what happened after that certainly would be enough for people to label him as a murderer, as so many Native Americans probably would.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, you know, I certainly don't try to defend him. I certainly do try to understand why he accepted this mission when it was obvious on all kinds of levels that he didn't want to do it. I mean, he tried to resign. I mean, he tendered his resignation twice during this mission, and it was rejected by his superior. He also tried to have a leave of absence right in the kind of the height of the battle, it, again, was rejected. He was quite ill at this time. This aneurysm thing that he had that he eventually died of was a problem. He could barely sit on a horse. He was plain worn out. And most of this campaign was carried out during the winter of 1863-1864 in a gorgeous but fairly haunting place to be in the winter, a place called Canyon de Chelly in Navajo country. And he just flat out didn't want to be there. And so, you know, I keep asking the question in my own mind is, you know, is it worse to carry out a brutal mission like this and believe in it, or to carry it out even though you don't believe in it? And I think in some ways it's worse. The latter is almost worse. He could have certainly resigned from the army entirely. And he certainly did disobey some of the orders he was given. For example, he was given an order, what was called a kill-all order, to kill every Navajo man that he saw, and he did not obey that. He rounded up prisoners, but he did not execute this order. So the real villain in this whole story is Carson's superior, a guy named James Henry Carleton, a general who was really the architect of the Long Walk. He's the one that believed that they should be force marched these 400, 500 miles from their home, and he had personally surveyed this location and believed that it had to work, and that not only would it work, but it would be a model for how to deal with all other American Indian tribes in the West. And you know, if the Navajos are really looking for a villain in this thing, I don't let Carson off the hook, but Carlton really is the guy.
Yeah. So they were forcibly relocated from the place that they had been living for forever in Arizona, and they were forced to go to New Mexico. And as you say, that it was terrible for the tribe. A lot of people died. It was interesting that the man who then came along and was sent to sort of see what was going on and decided that this was a failure and that they should be allowed to go back was Sherman. William Tecumseh Sherman was the guy who was sent and apparently said, "Look, this is terrible. This is a failure. These people are dying," and that they should be allowed to go back to Arizona where they had been living.
Yeah, and Sherman was certainly no sentimentalist on any subject, but particularly the subject of American Indians. He was he was quite harsh in dealing with American Indians and. Had been sent west after the Civil War to negotiate all sorts of treaties and relocate all manner of different tribes throughout the West. But he came to the Bosque Redondo, which was the name of the place where the Navajos were kept, the Round Forest, it was called, the Bosque Redondo. And he sat down and listened to what the Navajo leaders had to say and was moved by some of the things that they said. And he could tell that it was an abysmal failure on every front. I mean, you know, the point of this exercise was to make the Navajos self-sufficient. And they weren't self-sufficient. They used to be self-sufficient until they got to this place. And it seemed like everything that they tried failed. They planted corn, and it was overtaken by this thing called a cutworm, which devastated the entire crop. And... you know, the water of the Pecos was alkaline and led to dysentery, and they started developing cholera and, of course, venereal disease. The soldiers that were guarding the Navajos were spreading venereal disease, and on it went. But it was just a terrible failure, and it was extremely expensive, about $1 million a year, which was a lot of money back then. And Carlton, the guy who was behind all this, just would not admit that it was a failure, and was one of these sort of stay the course guys, you know, and in the face of all evidence. But you're right. So Sherman gets called in to kind of figure out what to do with them, and his idea was to move the Navajos even farther from their homeland, to move them to Oklahoma, which is, of course, had long been the kind of the preferred dumping ground for tribes since the time of President Jackson. But the Navajo said, no, you know, we do not want to go, especially this one elder named Barbancito, who gave this impassioned speech. And he said, you know, my desire goes in at my feet and comes out at my mouth, that you will take me back to my homeland before I die. And, you know, it certainly didn't hurt that Navajo country at that time was not viewed by the U.S. government as very valuable land. There was hope that maybe gold would be found there, but it wasn't. Of course, nothing of great value was found there until much later when we learned there was uranium deposits and coal deposits. But so it certainly helped, I think, their case with Sherman that they marched back to Navajo country. It wasn't land that was perceived to be very valuable to the U.S. government, but it was hugely valuable to the Navajos. I mean, this was their homeland, and this amazing country, you know, Ship Rock and the Monument Valley, Canyon de Chelly, the Grand Canyon, Chaco Canyon, all this extraordinary landscape was sacred to them, and part of their whole sort of tribal identity was intimately tied to that landscape. So they marched home, and this time a very much voluntary and joyful march home to their homeland, and now they are the largest American Indian tribe, and you know, living on an area that is. Like, it's impossible to describe how huge Navajo country is. It's larger than the state of Ohio, and it's like a country within the country. There's, you know, you can drive across it and reach a point in the middle where you turn on your car radio and you can't hear any signals except signals in Navajo. And I just think that's kind of amazing that we still have this sort of world within our world that kind of refused to to Christianize and refused to do what the U.S. government told them to do, and have thrived as their own entity, as their own people.
Yeah, that's a good place for us to end, and end we must because we're at the end of our time. If you want to read the book, it's a good story. The title is Blood and Thunder, An Epic of the American West, by our guest, Hampton Sides. The book is published by Doubleday. Hampton Sides is editor-at-large for Outside Magazine. Thanks very much for talking with us.
It's great to be on your show. Appreciate it.